Welcome back to Question Medicine. 2018 is the Inch Built down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And as this podcast is being released, I am on my way to FMX. Yes, the Family Medicine Experience. And if you're going to be there, then tweet me at Andrew Built or email me, andrewbuilt@gmail.com. And let's meet up. Let's have a drink. Let's talk all things medicine or all things not medicine. You pick. It's up to you. But I always love to hear from listeners, so let me know if you're going to be there. Now, today's podcast is a conglomerate of different articles that I've accumulated sitting on my desk, sitting in my house, that I just need to get rid of. So I'm going to quickly go through a ton of articles, and some of these are old articles. Some of these are from 2007, and they've just been sitting there waiting for me to talk about them. And today is their magic day. So without further ado, without any hesitation, any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Good to be back again. Andrew Built down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's get it started with a quick rapid-fire review through the medical literature. Journal of Neurology. Oh, back in November 2017, a article titled Early Weight Loss in Parkinson Predicts Poor Outcomes. Evidence from Incident Cohort Study. As you can tell, this is a cohort study. It looked at 240 controls, and they defined weight loss as greater than a 5% decrease from your baseline weight loss at the time of diagnosis. Now, the median follow-up was about 5 years, but if you had this 5% magical weight loss within 1 year of diagnosis associated with dependency hazard ratio of 2.1, which is not the most important number here. The most important number is the hazard ratio associated with death was 2.2. Yes, you were twice as likely to die, have a bad outcome, the ultimate bad outcome, actually, if you had this 5% weight loss in the first year. Now, is this from depression? Is this from not eating? I mean, likely when you're first diagnosing Parkinson, the lack of eating and that's probably not there yet, because hopefully you were catching this early on. So really, it's probably from depression. It's probably from just saying, man, I have this diagnosis. I don't know that to be true 100%, but if they lose 5% within the first year of diagnosis, that is a bad sign and something we need to be observant of. Speaking of bad signs, or at least bad reviews, on to the next article in JAMA Internal Medicine 2017, which was titled Association of Clinician Denial of Patient Requests with Patient Satisfaction. Basically, this article was looking at if we, the physician, don't give in to what the patient wants. When the patient says, hey, I think I need antibiotics. Hey, I think I need pain medication. Hey, I think I need laboratory requests. What did that do as far as the patient's perception of the care that they got? Or at least the perception of the physicians that were giving them the care. So there's no shocker here. I'm not going to go through all the numbers because it gets kind of tedious, but just over 1,300 visits in total. And right after the visits, they asked the patients, are you satisfied with the care that you got? Are you satisfied with the physician that just saw you? And lo and behold, if you did not get what you wanted, if you didn't get the laboratory test, the blood test, whether it was medically necessary or indicated or not, if you did or did not get it, well, there you go. If you didn't get it, then you were not happy with your care. If you did get it, then you were significantly and statistically more happy or happier with your care. I think we know this to be true. The sad part is we also know that patients are not their best doctors. What they read on Google isn't the end-all be-all, and what they diagnose themselves with or what imaging studies they think they need is not the end-all be-all. The hard part is, I think, in any shared decision-making conversation is to get any individual to understand that there are real harms that come with every drug and with every test we order. And just because we order a test to try to quote-unquote, make you feel comfortable, we might rule out the diagnosis that you were concerned about. However, we might then rule in a diagnosis that we had not even been thinking about, or at least lead to further testing, which could have true harms. So this is a complex situation. I think this is one that we all deal with every single day. And if you have a solution on how to fix it or how to make it better, let me know. Email me, tweet me. But there are a lot of great minds working on this, and no one seems to have a miracle answer. Now, speaking of smart people, there are many smart drug reps out there that will try to get you to buy their drug, and they will sell you on all sorts of different techniques. And the most recent drug, or the most recent one that I had read about, was FIASP. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. I think it might be FIASP. It's FIASP. Anyways, this is an insulin, and now it's a new ultra-fast acting mealtime insulin for adults. And that is going to be the trigger. Type 2 diabetes. Go ahead, doc. This is ultra-fast acting. It'll get to the glucose ultra-fast. Ultra-fast just makes us think that this is really, really good. Well, in all truth, they're not lying about this. It gets there about, or it starts working, about 5 minutes faster the Novolog. Yes, 5 minutes. 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, but that's not all. This FIASP drug costs about $275 a vial, or about $100 per pen, compared to Novolog, which, depending where you get it, costs about $25 to $150 a pen. Again, I would recommend going to GoodRx and finding the cheapest place for you, and then just going there and buying it. But it is ultra fast. It's ultra super duper fast. About 5 minutes faster than what you're probably already prescribing. And I can think of certain situations in life which 5 minutes might be worth it. For insulin getting to your diabetic patient, 5 minutes, probably not worth it. I probably will not be prescribing it. And speaking of other things that I likely will not be doing, that is being a woman with rheumatoid arthritis and smoking. For multiple reasons, I'm not going to be a woman, and I don't plan on taking up smoking. So, with that, that is in the Journal of Arthritis Care. There's a paper titled, Smoking Behavior Changes in the Early Rheumatoid Arthritis Period and Risk of Mortality During 36 Years of Prospective Follow-Up. Yes, 36 years. This is just back in January 2018 this year. They looked at right about 1,000 women that had RA, and then they followed them for 36 years, and they looked at, were they smoking before the diagnosis of RA, were they smoking after the diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, when were they smoking, when did they stop smoking, and how did that affect their mortality? The big shocking thing in this was that among people that smoked, and they had a greater than 5-pack-year smoking history after the diagnosis of RA, compared to those individuals who did not have RA, but also had this greater than 5-pack-year smoking history during the same time frame. So really it was you smoked and you smoked. We can say you both smoked about the same amount of time, except for this group of people had rheumatoid arthritis and this group of people who also smoked did not have rheumatoid arthritis. If you just compared those, the hazard ratios for those individuals that had rheumatoid arthritis and smoked was 3.67 versus 1.88. Yes, that is a double risk of mortality if you have RA and smoke. There are multiple reasons that you shouldn't smoke. You probably can name most of them off the top of your head, and the most important ones are death, dying, and mortality. It seems to be, if you're a woman and you have rheumatoid arthritis, this risk is even greater than we thought. And speaking of things that are greater than we thought, how about the actual risk of this acidosis with metformin? It seems for a while back in the 90s, there was a huge oopla, upla, kabing, kabang about, oh, if you give metformin and they've got to decrease the renal function, then you will kill the patient. Well, this is clearly not true, and we know it's not true, and the FDA has come out and said, hey, if they have mild to moderate kidney disease, don't worry about it. Go ahead and give them metformin because we know it saves lives. And this study out of the Journal of General Internal Medicine from February of earlier this year titled Mortality Associated with Metformin versus Sulfonylurea Initiation, a cohort study of veterans with diabetes and chronic kidney disease, looked at just this situation. They said if you have diabetes and you've got a GFR of greater than 90 or 60 to 90 or 45 to 59 or 30 to 44, then what's your risk of dying if you use metformin monotherapy compared to sulfonylurea monotherapy? Well, the metformin monotherapy was associated with a significant, yes, a significant 36% lower relative risk of dying. And it seemed like the individuals who benefited most from this was those individuals with the GFR of 30 to 44. The individuals that normally we would take off metformin and say, ooh, your renal function's getting a little too low. It's time to stop the metformin. Oh, yes, because you might get this, oh, feared complication of acidosis, or you might, something bad is going to happen to you. Well, it appears the thing that is bad that's going to happen to you is you taking them off the metformin when their GFR gets too low, because this is what saves lives. In all the other GFRs that I mentioned, the greater than 90, 60 to 90, 45 to 60, in those, the associated benefit tied to this was about 3 to 3.5 fewer deaths per 1,000 person years. So in 1 year, 1,000 people, we're talking about 3, 3.5 less deaths. However, in the GFR that was 30 to 45, we're talking 12 fewer deaths. And this makes sense because those individuals that have a lower GFR probably have higher risk for cardiovascular disease or cardiac disease. And we know metformin is, or what we think we know, is that it prevents coronary artery or cardiovascular disease. So it makes sense in higher risk of patients that it would give you more bang for your buck, more benefit. So to recap this one, sulfonylurea is still probably not that good. Metformin still pretty freaking awesome. And at most stores, or at many stores, many grocery stores, they give this away for free, or if not, Walmart sells it for the mere $9 or $4 a month or $9 every 3 months. There is no reason that every diabetic shouldn't be starting with metformin, unless, of course, they're under a GFR of 30. And even then, I bet there will be more literature in the future that says, we can probably still use it, just maybe at lower doses. On to the next article. And the next article I'm going to talk about is a condition that I've never had, but I do know someone who has suffered from it greatly. In fact, in all honesty, I think both my parents have suffered from it. And that is, no, not hemorrhoids, but plantar fasciitis. Plantar fasciitis. This is in the Journal of British Sports Medicine, titled Efficacy of Foot Orthotics for the Treatment of Plantar Heel Pain, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. In this analysis, the reviewers looked at 20 randomized trials in which the foot orthotics were compared with sham orthotics or other treatments or no treatment, and they said, how well do these foot orthotics do? Overall, there was no benefit to the custom orthotics, or just really no benefit at all to anything in particular during the short or long-term follow-up. So the authors in this article tend to say, listen, this really isn't worth it. You probably shouldn't do it. But I would go a step further and say, this may not be worth it, but you probably should do it. But you shouldn't spend a whole bunch of money doing it. If you just want to go to Walmart or Target or wherever you tend to buy your orthotics and get one of the cheaper ones on the shelf and see if it works for you, there probably is no harm in that, and there may be benefit. However, overall, you have to know that a majority of people are not going to get benefit from it. But if you're one of the select few that does get benefit from it, I think that this would be significantly beneficial. And those individuals that suffer from this seem so uncomfortable that what's a $20 orthotic really going to hurt, at least giving it a try? So for me, it's not a total wash, but for the most part, it's a wash. But not everything is a wash. Some things are just as good as advertised. And with that, I'm of course talking about blood pressure. Oh yes, blood pressure in this article in JAMA Internal Medicine back in April 2018 titled Association of Repeated Measurements with Blood Pressure Control in Primary Care. Now, we all know that the American Heart Association says that if you have a patient with a high blood pressure, then you should probably take it again. You should do repeat readings in the office because maybe they had white coat hypertension. Maybe they just rushed in from the car, rushed in from the office, and they're elevated. Once you let it sit down for a little bit, once you let the patient kind of breathe, get used to the environment, maybe their blood pressure goes down. Well, in this study, researchers looked at the second readings on 81,000 primary care visits for patients with hypertension. Now, on the initial measurement, the blood pressure was greater than 140 over 90. Now, the second readings were taken after 26,000 initially elevated values, and 36% of the second readings we're less than 140 over 90. Now, we can argue what's better, 140 over 90, 130 over 90, 120 over, I mean, you can go with whatever you want to go with. I don't really care. I think the point here is that if a patient comes in with an elevated blood pressure, we should probably be getting a second number. We should probably be rechecking it. The median improvement in this study was a systolic blood pressure of 8 millimeters of mercury. Don't get me wrong, it depended on how high was your blood pressure to how likely was it to come under 140, because that is what they were looking at. How often then did it come less than 140? But even 13% of the time that the blood pressure was systolic blood pressure, 160 to 180, the second reading, 13% of the time, 1 in 10, was then less than 140. We didn't need to do another medication. We just needed to do another recheck of the blood pressure. And I still need to go pack for this trip, so I'm going to wrap this podcast up here shortly. Now, you may have noticed in the last few podcasts, I seem to be talking a lot recently or lately about the quitting smoking, how you should be talking to your patients about quitting smoking, because if you don't, you've missed the boat. But don't feel bad if you don't get them to quit smoking, because it is an addictive substance. We know it's an addictive substance, and you can't always win. In fact, most time you won't win, but even if you help one person quit smoking, well, that's better than none. There is a study in the New England Journal of Medicine back in May titled A Pragmatic Trial of E-Cigarettes, Incentives, and Drugs for Smoking Cessation. Let's talk about this study for just a moment. There were about 6,000 smokers who were automatically enrolled into a randomized cessation trial. The participants were notified and they said that, listen, you will be enrolled in this smoking trial or the smoking cessation trial, and here's what you're going to be enrolled. You're going to be enrolled into the usual care, which consisted of smoking cessation education. You will be enrolled in free medication, which consisted of nicotine replacement agents, Wellbutrin or varenicline, with free e-cigarettes for those in whom the medication options failed or that they just couldn't tolerate. You'll be enrolled in a group that either had free e-cigarettes without other medications. So all you get was the e-cigarettes. Or you're enrolled in free medications, free e-cigarettes, and compensation as much as $600 if you stop smoking. So we're going to give you medications, e-cigarettes, and money. Or they said, we're going to give you medications, free cigarettes, and $600 in a deposit account in which the amount diminishes or will go down if you continue to smoke. Now, they didn't know which one they were rolled into, but they were rolled in them, 6,000 patients, and the overall cessation rate at 6 months was 1.3% of the individuals quit smoking. And this is when some of these individuals are being encouraged with $600, a little carrots of $600 waving in front of them saying, if you quit smoking, this money is all yours. And yet they couldn't do it. And maybe what's even worse or sadder is that those individuals that were offered free medications or free e-cigarettes or both did not have higher rates of cessation from smoking than just the usual smoking education or smoking cessation education that we normally give. Even when we gave them the medication for free, it didn't beat the overall just general education. Now, you might be saying, well, wait, what about the cash? I mean, overall, it was 1.3%, but what about the cash people? The people that were given money or had money and then taken away money? Well, they did quit significantly more often, about 2.5% of the time they quit compared to only 1% of the time for everyone else, or 0.5% actually for everyone else. So depending on how you look at it, that's a 400 to 500 relative risk, obviously, increase in smoking cessation if you were offered $600 in cash. However, the disturbing number is that that's still, even if you were offered free medication, free e-cigarettes, and cash, we could only get you to quit smoking 1 in 50 patients. So don't be discouraged if you're in clinic, if you're in office, if you're wherever, and you try to get a patient to quit and they don't quit, because even when we give them money, they still don't quit. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't stop trying, because it really is the number one thing that all other medications that we give combined really can't beat as far as cardiovascular risk. All right, I can hear Dusty zipping up her suitcase, which is my key to sign off here shortly and get going to our airplane ride, to the aeropuerto, if you will. But let me end with a listener email. A listener email that is a little bit of a long one, or at least the answer is going to be a little bit of a long one. And then I'll wrap this up. We'll move on. Again, if you're going to be in New Orleans for the next 4, 5, 6 days, let me know. Tweet me at AndrewBilt or email me, AndrewBilt@gmail.com, or just always feel free to email me at any time if you have any questions. And I will be happy to respond either in email or right here on Question Medicine. So here we go. Here's the email. It's from Jake. He says, "Hi, Andrew. I had a question regarding Question Medicine podcast number 69. You mentioned that the NNT and the United States Preventive Services Task Force say that the NNT for primary prevention of mortality with statins is infinity, which it is, but it is 1 in 217 to avoid a non-fatal heart attack and 1 in 313 to avoid a non-fatal stroke. He says, how is this extrapolated and then how can any of this be proven? How can you say if someone ends up dying from an MI or a stroke that they wouldn't have benefited from a statin?" So there's more to this email and I'll get to it, but let's just stop right there and answer the first part of this question. So remember, you don't die from an MI or a stroke, or at least the MIs and strokes that are occurred because you're not on a statin wouldn't have been prevented if you were on a statin. And MIs and strokes, or deaths from MIs and strokes, are actually pretty rare when you think about it. Usually people don't die from the actual MI or stroke itself. And what you might be asking, or what Jake might be asking here, is what if they die from a complication from the MI or stroke, which is a completely different question. I mean, you might be saying, what if you get pneumonia from aspiration that occurred because of the stroke? Well, that might have been benefited from a statin, but we would just never really know that answer. It would be like saying, if you get the flu shot and it makes you cough less, and then because you're coughing less, you're not coughing while you're driving, and because you're not coughing while you're driving, it then prevents you from getting in a car accident. Well, maybe this is true, but we don't know for sure, and that's a little bit of a stretch. We can't extrapolate those numbers. We can just say it makes you cough less. Now, he also wanted to know, how are these numbers done? Well, they're usually looked at in a meta-analysis form, which is then obviously just a big mass of all the studies piled in, and then you use each individual trial's inclusion, exclusion criteria, depending on how they did it. Now, my favorite study in looking at all these studies is the cholesterol treatment trial list, which published in Lancet, and they had individual patient data, the best of the best, if you will, and they found that there was no primary benefit in patients with an ASCVD risk score of less than 20% at 10 years. 20% at 10 years, no benefit in primary prevention. Now, Jake goes on to say, but hold on. The United States Preventive Services Task Force still recommends statins for primary prevention. And he is absolutely right. They do. They say adults age 40 to 75 with no history of cardiovascular disease, one or more cardiovascular disease risk factor, and a calculated 10-year CVD event risk of 10% or greater is qualifying you for a statin. But I think it's important to note that some of the trials that were used by the United States Preventive Services Task Force analysis included high-risk patients or patients with cardiovascular disease. Remember, secondary prevention is not primary prevention. They're very different. We know secondary prevention, you should be on a statin. That's not a question here, nor there, nor anywhere. You should have a statin for secondary prevention. But pure primary prevention, well, that is up for debate. And if you mix in trials with individuals who have cardiovascular disease or need secondary prevention, and you mix them in with the primary prevention, well, then you kind of muddy the water a little bit as who actually needs the medication. And the United States Preventive Services Task Force found that there was an absolute benefit of about 0.5% for statins for non-fatal heart attacks. It worked out to, again, a number of 217. But this number needed to treat of 217 is probably artificially improved or lowered by the predominance of events that occurred in the high-risk individuals or secondary prevention individuals. So again, if you have a huge group of 100 people and they're all primary prevention, your number needed to treat is going to be rather large. But let's say 70 of your 100 are primary prevention and 30 of your population is either really high risk, like 30 or 40%, or secondary prevention, well, then that's going to lower your number needed to treat because of that 30 people that will then artificially lower your number needed to treat. Jake goes on to say, I asked because I was cycling with another doctor friend who is in his 60s and his LDL is consistently greater than 190. He says if he takes red yeast rice, he can get it below this, but he has seen too many quote-unquote healthy colleagues and friends die of MIs that were not on statins, so he prefers to take a statin. Let me just hold right there and say, yes, he can absolutely get his cholesterol lower taking red yeast rice. The problem is not the number, the problem are the events tied to the number. And again, in the Journal of Family Practice, there's a systematic review on the herbs for serum cholesterol reduction. One of those herbs was red yeast rice. And it found, surprise, you can get a lower number, but there was no evidence that these herbs improved the clinical outcomes, such as heart attacks and strokes. Although they appeared to be safe, we don't have evidence that they fix what we really care about or what the patient really cares about. All right, he goes on to say that his friend, this doctor friend that takes the red yeast rice, ended up having a calcium score as well, which did show that he would benefit from a statin, which helped him commit to long-term statin use. Which brings me to my next question. In the December 2016 primary care reviews and perspectives, there was a piece there that said the calcium score and CRP, or the blood test CRP, could help or would help risk stratify patients, and it was recommended. And so Jake's saying, wait a second, on Primary Care App, you guys said that this is beneficial. So now what? What's going on here? Yes, you are correct. Primary Care App did recommend CRP and did recommend the calcium score, but this was based on an expert interview. And I remember I had a huge problem with this. In fact, I had a really big problem with this. And Rob Orman and I went back and forth and I said, there's no way we can post this. This is absolute crudola. This is an expert opinion. This is not evidence-based. We are here to give CME. We need to give evidence-based, not opinions. And I was pretty much told, listen, then give your opinion in the summary, which I did. But I don't think everyone listens to the summary. It was quite frustrating, to be honest with you. So that is part of my beef, I guess, with that particular episode I didn't quite like. Let me give you what the evidence actually says right here, right now. Listen up. This is the evidence. Basically, CRP is missing a vowel, and I'll let you decide which vowel and where to place that vowel. But if you look at the papers on this, and particularly a piece back in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at the emerging risk factors such as CRP and fibrinogen, the authors used data from 52 prospective observational cohort studies with nearly 250,000 patients with a follow-up of almost 7 years or until the first cardiovascular event. Now, cardiovascular event was defined as a fatal heart disease, myocardial infarction, or stroke. The mean age of all the participants in the study was about 62 years old, which sounds a lot like your friend. And the authors first determined cardiovascular risk using the baseline model, the thing that we all use from the Framingham or ASCVD, age, sex, smoking, blood pressure, diabetes, and total cholesterol. And then once they had that, they started adding variables one by one, such as HDL cholesterol, CRP, and fibrinogen. Adding these variables did increase the area under the curve, but only very slightly, like less than 1%. And that area under the curve was the area under the curve for the first cardiovascular event. So let me break down what they're really saying here. They're saying if you use what we already use, let's say age, sex, smoking, blood pressure, diabetes, the total cholesterol, you're already using that, you might get 80, 90% of your individuals, or you're going to capture those individuals that will be at quote unquote high risk or at risk for a cardiovascular event. Now, if you add a CRP, you might go from 80 to 81%. You might go from 85% of all individuals you're going to capture to 86%. Now, the question is in moving at that 1%, or actually even less than 1%, are you then going to capture those individuals and convince them to start taking a statin? I would say probably not. That extra 0.5% or 1% of individuals, of those individuals, you then have to, how many of those individuals, because of this one test, are you actually going to convince to take a statin who otherwise would have not taken a statin just based on a pure shared decision-making conversation? I would say the number is incredibly small, and you likely don't need a $50 to $100 test, which is how much a CRP costs, in order to get you that extra information. Just a simple shared decision-making conversation with the patient sitting right in front of you will probably do it. Now, let's go over to calcium scores and talk about those for just a split second. I think I've done it before on Question Medicine, but let's hit it on again. The calcium score does have a decent association with cardiovascular events. I cannot deny that. If it is unbelievably high, you do have a higher risk. There's no doubt. I can't deny it. And this evidence can be found when you look off of spin-off evidence of other trials, such as the Jupiter trial. Thus, I cannot argue that the calcium score isn't a good test, but it is only a good test if it changes what you will do and has no harm. We know that this test comes with radiation. Plus, we find things like lung nodules that need further follow-up and possible biopsies, and this can only be used in this middle risk or middle low risk individual patient population, because if they're incredibly high risk, you don't need to order the test to have the test tell you that they need a statin. You already know they need a statin. If the patient's incredibly low risk, well then again, you don't need the test to tell you that they don't need a statin because they're already really low risk. They get no benefit from it. So you only need this middle group risk. I would say this middle group-ish risk would be about the 7 to 7.5%. That seems to be kind of on the low end, but maybe if they have a high calcium score, you could put them on it. Now, if they have a high calcium score, do they actually benefit? Do they actually change what they're doing based on it? Well, there was a study on it, wouldn't you know, in JAMA titled The Impact of Electron Beam Tomography with or without Case Management on Motivation, Behavioral Changes, and Cardiovascular Risk Profile. They took 450 people and performed a coronary calcium on all of them, but then they only gave the results to some of the individuals and not the others. And then they followed them up after 1 year to note if their ASCVD risk score actually changed. Meaning, if you were randomized to the group that had the results, did you maybe lose weight? Did you stop smoking? Did you start on a statin? Did you have better blood pressure control? If you got your score and said, ooh, I'm kind of at high risk, compared to those individuals who didn't get their results, they have no idea what their risks are. What had happened to them? Did they maybe let their weight go a little bit more than normal because they didn't have the risk? Did they maybe not start taking the statin because they didn't have these numbers in front of them to show them that, hey, maybe you should start taking a statin? Well, wouldn't you know it, when they followed them up, there was no difference between groups whether you got the results or didn't get the results in their ASCVD risk score. Now, baseline entering this was about 6%, which is pretty darn close to that 7.5% magical number that I was referring to. Because again, if they're at a 1% risk, we don't need to order this test. If they're at a 16, 17, 20% risk, we don't need to order this test. So this, I think, was probably one of the closest studies we're going to get to, does this actually help? Do these coronary calcium scores actually help us make a change in what we're doing? And so far, I would say no. Jake closes out his email and he says, I guess with your information, I'm scratching my head with what's the right thing to do regarding statins for primary prevention, and are the CRP and calcium score effective? P.S. Are you going to post the show notes to the Questioning Medicine on your website? Let me end all this, and now then I will end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. I think the best thing to do is don't order a CRP or a calcium score. Just look at the risk factors of the patient sitting in front of you. Age, smoking, diabetes, hypertension, cholesterol. And then plug it into the ASCVD calculator and see what you think. If secondary prevention, then they always need a statin. If primary, then it's 6-1 way, half a dozen the other. And if you have a shared decision-making conversation and document as such, then I really don't think you can go wrong. And if you do go wrong and you document that as such and you get sued, then you can email me and I will be happy for the price of a plane ticket, fly in for your court date and be your expert witness, because we just don't have solid evidence saying that this absolutely needs it, this absolutely doesn't. It should really be up to the patient preference. If the patient says, listen, I am so deathly scared of a heart attack, stroke, or any kind of cardiovascular, coronary artery disease complication, I'm willing to take anything in the book to prevent this, well, then this might be for them. But if you have another patient that says, well, after hearing what you say, after hearing you say that there actually may not be any real benefit on this, then I'm willing to take my risk on 1 in 217 at best. I'm willing to push the envelope here just a little bit. Well, then again, I think it's beneficial. Because remember, the number needed to treat these 1 in 217 is based on the patient that's willing to take the medication every single day for 10 years. You don't miss a day. You don't stop. You take the medication every single day for 10 years. I know most patients are not willing to do that. All right, it is time for me to wrap this up. So let's go to the final notes. Here we go. In 120 seconds or less, Parkinson patients that lose 5% of their weight in the first year have a hazard ratio of death of 2.2, or double, compared to those who did not lose weight. So pay close attention to the newly diagnosed Parkinson's patients that have weight loss. And if you don't do what patients want, then you're going to get worse patient satisfaction surveys. I don't know what to make of this other than patients think that they know best. Fiasp is a new insulin that works so fast, it's probably 5 minutes faster on average than what you're already prescribing, and it costs at least twice as much. So for me, it's sitting on the shelf. If you are a woman, you have rheumatoid arthritis, then you really need to stop smoking. Metformin is still an awesome drug and should be given for a GFR down to 30. Shoe orthotics likely do not benefit everyone with plantar fasciitis, but for $20 and the patient sitting in front of you, it might be worth a try, but don't spend an insane amount of money on those high custom fit orthotics, just not beneficial. Now, people like to smoke, so don't be upset if you can't get a patient to quit smoking. The average numbers in the studies for just usual care is about 1 in 200, which means you are going to fail 199 times before you get that one patient to stop smoking. So don't be discouraged, but keep encouraging every patient to stop smoking. And in the end, just use our baseline numbers and risk factors for the ASCVD and starting statins, and keep the fancy stuff and the fancy blood tests and studies on the sidelines until we have evidence that actually support their cost and utility. And there we go. This is sort of a long one. I am off to Family Medicine Experience. Let me know if you're going to be in New Orleans. And with that, I will end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.